It's time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 229. It's Dave and I talking about a bunch of stuff, like programming after 30, about development environments and all the different possibilities there. We're going to talk about how you get content from clients. Is there some magic bullet for that? Is it a tech problem? Is it a process problem? What's up with that? We're gonna dig into REMs versus M's again. You know, why not? Seems like a fun one to get into. We're gonna try to come up with some metaphors for like Angular versus React. Like, how do you think about those kind of things? We're gonna give it a shot anyway. I should mention that this show is brought to you in part by Rollbar, which we'll also tell you more about later in the show. The important URL though there is rollbar.com/shoptalkshow, which gets you 3 free months of their Bootstrap plan, which is very generous. It's an error tracking and reporting software, which pretty much every website ever needs. Extremely valuable software. And I should mention, I have a new book I wrote. It's called Practical SVG. It's out on A Book Apart. If you Google Practical SVG, you should be able to find it pretty easily. It's available from A Book Apart and, you know, comes as a print book if you want, or in any of the ebook formats, which are very comfortable and awesome to read. They did a great job of converting the book into those formats. So if you want to level up your SVG skills, I highly recommend my own book for that. Anyway, Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a journalistic endeavor about websites. I'm Dave Rupert with
me. Whoa, I'm so careful about that journalism word.
I guess, scratch that, start over, not journalism.
Well, yeah, it's just, we don't adhere to journalistic standards, but practice it in some form or another. What's up, Dave? How are you doing?
Hey, you know what grinds my gears?
What grinds your gears?
Oh, I got a gear grinding right now. When you're trying out a new SaaS, software as a service platform,
what do you do?
You make an account, you log in, you kind of build something, hello world it, see how good it is, right? Yep. You're like, okay, cool. And maybe you build a whole thing or something. And you're like, this is great. Okay, I don't want to pay for this anymore. I want my company to pay for it, right?
Yeah.
So you're like, oh, okay. Now we have to what? You have to,
go in and make sure that you delete the card out of it, because I don't know. That seems like the safest way.
Yeah. Like, so you have to go and like transfer that, or even to a client. You have to like transfer that, or you have to like make a team and then transfer that to the team. And then the team has to be set up for billing, but like teams are usually the most expensive tier plan on an application.
Yeah.
So just to like get past the hello world, you're like $100 a month or something to use it. You know, that just grinds my gears.
We did a little research on team pricing, because we offer teams at Copen too, and they're actually a little cheaper per head. Mm-hmm. And that's not normal. Like Dropbox is like, oh, do you want a team account? You get no features for it, and it's just more per head. It's really weird.
Yeah.
But I think offering is the one credit card thing, like the grouping of the thing. It's pretty
common. Oh, so one bulk charge, not 100 little micro charges or whatever.
Yeah, I think so. Just the ease of management is worth it. And that prices at some like level of corporation, they just don't even care. They're just like, oh, you need this to do your business? Okay, put it on the card. You know, like there's less scrutiny.
Yeah, it just grinds my gears. It just grinds my gears a little bit, because you just want to like progress, but now you have to like stop the whole ship, transfer a whole thing, and like set up accounts for everybody. You have to set up the team account. You have to set up all the sub teams accounts, and it's just not easy, Chris.
I think as another part of this, which is just the like one of the eternally difficult things about software development, is the like foreseeing the future of how you should structure your database for things. Like, There's so many mistakes to make. Like I'm, you know, just I don't have a mistake to share with you necessarily about CodePen, but kind of like there's a concept of a pen, and it has a database that's called the pens table, and it's literally a database table that stores all the pens in it. But like, who owns that pen is a choice you have to make. And do you like store that data in the users table? Like, does the user have like an array of pens that they own, or does the pen have a user as part of it? You know, like, I'm not the best person to understand this, but there's mistakes to be made there. Or do you have like an ownership table in between those two that links them? Because down the line, somebody might write in and say, hey, I'd like to, you know, it should be easier to transfer the ownership of a pen, right? Like in your case, mm-hmm. like, and I'm sure, I don't know if you're talking about CodePen or not, but it could be anything, you know?
No. This is a general problem with like 10 services I'm having right now.
So. And you're like, I'd like to transfer the ownership of this thing. And then the developers or customer service gets back to you and be like, you know, that's just not something we offer or whatever. You'll have to delete it and rebuild it or something. But that comes down to how easy was that feature to develop based on the original structure that you chose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wish I could like start these up and then it would offer me like, hey, we noticed you're doing something. You're going to want a team account later on if you're not by yourself. So would you like to migrate this to the team account? It's a one click. And I would say yes every time. And by the way, we won't charge you for it until you tweet about it or something. I don't know. Until it's public or you have to like, you still have the same personal limitations until you fire it up or something. That's the thing. They want to get you your money and that's fine. I want them to have my money, but I struggle with just the jump. It goes from like free to $100 and you're just like developing, right? You're just trying to iterate on this idea, or this client project or whatever. But you know, I guess if it's worth, I don't know, if I'm getting money from clients, it's probably worth $100 a month or something. So
Greg, I'm sure everybody out there wants so badly to know which thing you're talking about.
10 things.
Yeah.
You don't it's 10 things. It's your thing. Like if you're working on it right now, you're adding code into that machine. I'm complaining about that machine. Anyway. Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
Welcome to Shop Talk Show. Right. It's a podcast about web design and development. We do questions and answers all day long.
There's an audio one. Are you ready for it? Or did you
know? I am so ready. Here we go. Are you ready? Josh Smith calls in.
Hi, I recently heard you guys talk about the virtues of CSS frameworks. One con that you mentioned was a huge amount of unused CSS that gets bundled with each website. Well, that isn't necessarily the case all the time, at least with frameworks like Foundation. Foundation specifically built with SAS and heavily leverages imports for each feature. Basically, if you don't need the feature, it's up to the developer not to include it. I think these frameworks get a bad rap, usually from the uninitiated. Once someone told me that they don't use somebody else's code and then went right back to using WordPress. But in summary, modern frameworks are super powerful and are not for the beginner. They use SAS to limit the size of the end product, but also incorporate even more enhancements like Gulp and Grunt, which can further reduce size of CSS, amongst other things. But I'd just like to hear what you guys think about modern frameworks and how they can fit into a development workflow.
This is one of those eternal questions. Josh didn't even necessarily have a question there. He was just trying to share some knowledge about specifically how Foundation works in combating that idea that, you know, you ship more CSS than you use kind of thing, which I agree with him is certainly something that people talk about with frameworks, a thing that they don't like. And it's just so hard. It's so hard to tackle this massive question. We've tried many times and tend towards the answer of like, hey, if it works for you and you're productive, cool, which I still agree with, I guess.
I'm pro framework. I think if it helps you get the job done, I'm pro framework. I also am pro like developing your own framework for your project, for your needs. But if Foundation meets your needs, then don't reinvent the wheel. I'm very much a fan of that. I would say, so here's, can I debate Josh, who is not on the show? Can I debate him? So there's, you can like comment out includes and it should like be thinner and lighter and faster every include that you comment out. I think though, the like number of people who do that is like somewhere to close to 1%, right? Of all the websites that like are using Bootstrap.
It's not the default, so people don't do it.
Yeah, it's not the default. So people just roll with the defaults like 100% of the time. So I'm reading a book about this. It's called Nudge by Thaler. And it's all about just how you use the defaults will nudge people in a direction, whether intended or not. But that's to say, these frameworks like Bootstrap and Foundation, they do allow you to comment it out. So when I went to a conference recently and there's quite a bit of like framework hating, like Bootstrap's good for prototyping and then you have to rewrite everything. Yeah. And I'm just,
my sound skin bites, crawled, you know?
Yeah. My skin crawled. Cause I was like, well, you can like, what? No, like use the code. It's good code. It's just fine. It's probably 10% different than what you would write. So I'm with Josh in that I kind of hate the hate that comes to frameworks just because they are cheap and free and kind of very similar. They produce very similar websites, but what are you doing that's so radical by yourself?
I don't know. It's hard to debate because you either, you have used one or you haven't, and you have an opinion based on that. It's so tricky. It's kind of like, I don't even know if I want to go there. But one of the things is that like...
You were going to go hot button political issues.
Maybe. Yeah. Or like how when you're comparing like a large industry of things, any one person probably hasn't tried 15 of those things in a really intense way and can really like compare them based on that experience. They're just like, I don't know, I used X and X worked for me, thus I'm a big fan of X. I'm going to vote for X in polls. I'm going to tell people I use X on Twitter or whatever. And it's not based on a review of XYZ, AB, food, like all of them. It's just one micro experience. So it's hard to say, like it sounds like Josh has used Foundation, likes Foundation, has been successful with Foundation, is now defending Foundation, which is perfectly fine, but whatever. Isn't necessarily representative of every single framework out there and every single level of experience and every single project and all that type of stuff. I can't talk about it either because I haven't really used Foundation in a production project nor any other framework. I've never shipped a production project with the framework in it. I don't do as many websites as you have probably and have a different experience that way. But I kind of feel like if it's your job to be the CSS person for a project, you should have a pretty good understanding of the CSS there. And and also kind of how my brain works. Like I just, we need some little flyout menu. Oh, I'm going to mock it up in Sketch or whatever. Oh, I like the way that looks. My brain is just like, okay, so how would I CSS this? And then I do that. I would struggle more if I'm like, okay, I see what we're trying to go for here. What's the closest foundation component to it? Let me grab that and then style it to be more like, I think that I would struggle with that more. I would find that more obnoxious. Be like, dude, this is like, between 4 and 12 lines of CSS here. And then, maybe a quirk that I'll handle and maybe a media query and maybe a hover state or something. I'm like, not a big deal. It's kind of my thing. I enjoy that. It's also one of my superpowers.
Yeah. I think you could also be really like, there's kind of this idea that people who write frameworks don't know CSS, which maybe you're kind of tangentially touching on. But I'm also like, if your company has a style guide, like hiring somebody who knows Bootstrap, that's like, they're probably going to be really good employee. Like they already know how to work with a pre-existing framework. And if your company has a style guide, you have a pre-existing framework and they'll be able to work with that. I think that's very awesome. I'm currently working with a framework for a client, and I kind of don't like their grid, you know, it's terrible to say, but which is such a foundational element. So I'm like, I'm doing kind of what you were saying, Chris. It's like, I see their grid and I'm like, well, I might rewrite my own, and that's the worst thing, but I'm going to actually, hopefully, I don't know, rewrite it and maybe propose it and just say, hey, this might be easier to work with. This is solving all the problems everyone's hitting. But
I got another good example. I like the grid one. That's a good one, especially because you could just rip it out of the current framework and replace your own in there that you like better, which is totally not a big deal.
Yeah, in theory, it's a hot swappable component. But
a friend, my friend Richard.
my friend. Is this okay?
Yeah, this is a story.
It's not you. It's not you.
No. Well, this is just the start of a related story. Asked me literally yesterday evening. He sent me a screenshot, and the screenshot was a number input and then a text input and then a select box. And the two inputs on the top were styled very nicely. They used a custom font. They had a bunch of padding around them. They're like big, fluffy, nice inputs. And then the select below it was just a browser default select. And it looks weird, right? It's like these two very stylized inputs. And then the browser default in a native browser default select, I would think in any platform, including on the Windows stuff, is like very narrow and thin. You can't just take a browser default select element and add padding to it. It just doesn't take it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, is there a way to style that? Like, why can't I just like apply some padding to it? And I'm like, well, you kind of just can't. But then I'm like, oh, but you kind of can, right? And I was trying to remember the tactics for styling a select without JavaScript, without like replacing it with a div and doing all that stuff. And it reminded me of Mark Otto, who we've had on the show, has this repo and website called WTF Forms. And I was like, I forgot how awesome this is. This is really nice if nobody's out there seen it before. And it covers, for example, how to restyle a select. And there's no JavaScript in this repo at all. This is all CSS solutions to doing this. And just like look at the like chunk of CSS that's required to style this select element. It's like, you know, you should make it inline block for some reason. And then to make it full width, you can make it width equals 100%. And then here's the real trick, though, to like getting some padding around it is to set the appearance property of it to none, but you need to vendor prefix that for the ones, you know, and so that takes away like the browser default styling, but it still kind of behaves like a select. Then you can set the background color and the line height and the font family, and then make sure you reset the border, otherwise it hangs on to that weirdly, and then reset the border radius, and then make sure you set like a Moz focus ring or whatever, because otherwise the styling won't be there in Firefox when you select it. And then, oh, you've lost now the little arrow, and the little arrow pointing down was part of the affordance, sorry, we're using that word again, for what a select button is. So he uses a pseudo element on a parent element to re-add the little pointing arrow down, and then hover states and focus states and active states and a little trick for IE to deal with the expanding state and stuff. It's like, there's a lot. I actually just copied and pasted the code over so I could count the lines. There's 112 lines here for a select here. And that's the kind of thing that sometimes when we talk about frameworks are really like leaning on the heavy lifting that someone else has done to really make this work really super well. I would use this in a heartbeat for styling a select with CSS. It's really nice CSS. It comes with this framework.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That was a tangential.
No, I'd like that. I was going to say from Filament Group, Todd Parker has a like a gist, and it's like all the CSS required, and it's like 108 lines or something, 100 lines of CSS to style a select box.
Oh, it's the same thing then, I'm sure.
Same thing, yeah. Yeah.
But it can be done, and it really looks good.
Right. Yep. All right, let's go. Next question. Sup, fellas. Hey, sup, Steve Polito. Thank you for writing in. I'm starting to finally understand the concept of Angular and React. However, I'm struggling to understand when I would reach for one over the other. Currently, this is how I perceive each framework. When I think of Angular, I think of single page apps. All I picture are lists of data that a user would be able to easily filter. Okay. When I think of React, I think of components. However, I just think of them as widgets in WordPress. I think I'm missing some of the greater value of what React has to offer. Could you give me an example of a use case for Angular and a use case for React?
Yeah, that sounds fun.
I think they're going to end up being closer than you want them to, Steve, but we can take a shot.
I heard once, Chris, that I was listening to JS Jabber, who we've also had as guests on the show, and they had some guest on there talking about Angular 2.0 and when's it going to drop. I still don't think it has or whatever. But somebody said, I'll paraphrase, that like Angular is if you like templates, and React is if you like JSX. It was kind of like, if you really want to boil it down really far, that's one way you can think of it. Do you like mustache-y style things? Then you maybe you'll like Angular. Do you like JSX? Maybe you'll like React, even though maybe that's not entirely fair. But I think it may be the case, since they do a lot of similar things. I have less experience with Angular, so maybe I'll let you take that if you...
Do you like spending weeks setting up a site? Then React is your choice. If you want it like a 6-minute fix, Angular is really great. I think the kind of big thing is, I think Steve got it right. React is kind of something you kind of layer in to your markup. Like you just kind of start using standard HTML as templates, and React is way more on the component side of things. Like you have the header, and inside the header you have a nav component or something like that. I think React kind of leverages these components.
It is definitely component based, but in some of the pages we were working on, it really turned out to be like, let's just not definitely don't think of like a page and just be like, I'm just going to refactor this one widget in the sidebar with React or whatever. It really did not pan out that way. It really made more sense to really to cover the page in React. And even if it's a simple thing, if it's just navigation or whatever, just rewrite it as a component, get yourself in that land, is going to be much better for us. State is the big thing, though. I feel like somebody even today was like, oh, you're redoing CSS tricks in React. I'm like, no, absolutely not. It's not necessary. That's not a use case really for React. And then I had this baby thought thinking of, you know, state is abstract. Let's set that aside for a moment. Is there a lot of things that you can click on the page that aren't links? Then it's like territory to use one of these things. You know, like we're sitting in Trello right now. I don't know if it uses React or not, but there's tons of things that you can click that like do stuff that aren't links. Like I'm going to add a list, then add a comment, then add a checkbox to it, then drag and drop to rearrange a thing in there, and then drag it to a different list, and then do some searching and stuff. It feels like a one-page app. It really is a one-page app. Perfect use case for something like React. And then think of all those things that you're doing as like manipulating the state of this page, and the fact that React has this like blob of state that it's working with, and the whole UI is based on that state. Things start to make sense. Not every use case has it. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are like, oh, I feel so behind. I don't know React. I'm not working with it. It's, you know, I'm like, well, you know, maybe 90% of the work you do is just like informational pages. It's WordPress themes. It's, you know, home pages for lawyers or whatever. There's not a lot of stuff you click on those pages that do things that aren't links. I don't know.
I'm trying to think, like, if I was writing a really cheap, like, data consumer from an existing API, like, I don't know, let's say CodePen had an API and I just wanted to grab, like, recent pens from these 100 people or something, I would probably use Angular to do that. I wouldn't build out a whole React infrastructure. I would just have, like, a list in Angular, because Angular is really good at, like, cheap data consumption if you have the API. But I don't know if you need like
it has a router too, though. That kind of is. I think once you're thinking about state and Angular, then you're in kind of router territory.
Yeah, I think any at the moment you are sort of doing state, I feel like React is maybe stronger. That state tree in React is so beautiful. And just
right.
It's just so nice.
And then as soon as you're doing heavy state, you really throw Redux into the mix, which is this way that says like, okay, this isn't just, it's still the same state tree, but in order to ever touch it, you dispatch these actions to change it. It's like controls the flow of how you change the state. It's less of a wild west of just like anybody can change state whenever. It's like, nope, this is Redux is demands how you change the state. And that's kind of nice because it saves you from yourself. It's like this learning curve, but then it like stifles complexity over time. We've even thrown immutable JS on top of that, which says that like now these specific areas as part of the state can never be changed unless you use immutables API kind of thing to change it, which is like yet another learning curve and complicates things even more, but then says that like now you can like compare to new state and old state really efficiently. I think that's the kind of the point of it. I think we've really go down a rabbit hole here, but it makes your kind of our React Redux setup even more efficient because it's going to be like, oh, I see only a very little part of this change. So it's a really quick comparison and it knows that it doesn't need to re-render this whole sidebar over here. It can just re-render one tiny little part of it because Immutable made that comparison really cheap and smart. That was a rabbit hole. I'm sure other people could do a good job here. Dave did a good, I think when you're thinking of lists, I guess maybe that isn't so far off, huh?
I mean, the one that comes to mind is Ionic framework, again, back to frameworks, but it kind of creates a iOS-y or Android-y material design-y app using HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and it kind of leans heavily on Angular to do all the data consuming from your pre-existing API, and that's why I mentioned that. You can hello world in Ionic really quick and start getting a feel for how they are doing React, but I think they try to follow Angular, the conventions. Right? Angular. And if you want to get a feel for React, Wes Boss's course is
React also made a hello worldy thing themselves, where it's like a CLI kind of thing where you can just be like, make me a new React project, and it has some like opinionated things that it yanks down and gives you a little hello world project. So they're aware, I think they're doing the smart things. I recently did an article I posted on the Media Temple blog about the dev tools around them too. I think I would assume Angular has some pretty good dev tools, but it's cool. You're writing JSX and then all that stuff gets all like in React land. If you choose to, that stuff is very weird to look at. But by the time it makes it to the DOM, it doesn't really look like JSX anymore. Like these like HTML elements that you've invented as part of JSX are gone now and they're divs or whatever. But the React dev tools, when you go look at it, is, you can see what you originally wrote. You can see all the props on there and stuff. It's like DevTools for your JSX. It's pretty cool.
And it adds it right into your little web inspector, right?
Yeah, totally. It's a new tab in your web inspector. And then Redux has one as well, which is really great because it's kind of amazing. You're like, oh, I've opened a modal dialog. That has changed the state of this application so that the open state of this dialog is open. And then you can see in the Redux DevTools, oh, I see an action was dispatched to do that. And then I closed it. Oh, I can see that an action was dispatched to close it. And now that's created like a little bit of a timeline situation. So you can like drag a scrubber back and forth and you can see that modal open and then see it closed because it can replay those actions backwards and forwards, which is pretty powerful. You can also be like, oh, I'm having a bug here. Let me export the state as it is and send it to you, Dave, and you can just import it as a chunk of JSON, and the application will instantly look like it looks to me because it's this, the state is just this chunk of JSON that you can export and import through the dev tools, which is cool.
Wow.
That's everything I know. That's everything I learned about web development.
I was going to say, there's like one-way data binding and two-way data binding, but I don't know and I can't explain it, so I'm not...
maybe not the perfect one. Let's go to Mark Shanfrani.
Shanfrani.
What's the deal with REMS versus EMS? More comfortable territory for us, is it? Or is it? Everybody seems to say EMS are better than REMS. Do they say that? I don't. But how do you deal with the cascading of EMS? If I use EMS for changing an H1's font size and padding, then I have to recalculate the EMS for padding anytime I want to change that font size. Things get really messy when you start getting nested. All I've read is that cascading in M's is an issue. I think that personally, I think the classic one is when you set the li value to like M1.1 or whatever, and then imagine a nested list. And you know, as you get further down the nest, the cascading M's are making those list items bigger and bigger and bigger, which is awkward. What makes sense to me is to use rems for font sizes and M's for padding and margin, since they're related. I don't see anybody doing this though, so I feel like that's wrong. It seems like way more complicated. You know, it seems like all this is way more complicated than just using pixels. Can you explain how to go about converting a PSD? It looks a lot simpler to just use the mockup, you know, set the heading to 28 pixels, you know, the H2 to 26 pixels or whatever, that kind of thing. Is that an outdated approach? There's so much to unpack here. I would say certainly I'm more comfortable in rems just because I kind of like how they don't affect each other or whatever. Just a personal kind of thing.
Hold on one second. Jessica, clear my schedule. I have to talk about rems versus ems. Okay. Right, is everybody ready? Here we go. I think my favorite example of this is like line height. Because it's kind of by default sort of an M-based thing. You know, you, it says set my heading to my H1 to 28 picks, and then you set your line height to 36 picks. Well, son, you played yourself, because somebody's going to come along and say, oh, I want that to be 30 pixels, and now, or like 38 pixels, and now it's the same as your line height or bigger than your line height, and then it's crunch.
Line height's like one of those ones where I like, I don't use any ish because it supports not having any, just a multiplier, and I like that, so that one's fixable.
Yeah, and I mean, that's basically M's in a nutshell.
Okay.
I think if you're using rems for font sizes,
you might as well use pixels.
And M's for padding, that's fine. That's great. I think you could do that. I think you could even use pixels for font sizes. I just think that when, because it used to be like fonts or browsers would fix pixels sizes when you like Command Plus or Control Plus to make it bigger. And that was like an accessibility problem. Yeah, they don't do that anymore. Right. So that advantage to M's is now gone. So I don't know that you need to do that, but if you're like changing, my coworker Trent Walton does this a lot, changing the body font size off of like the type size off of a base body size in a media query, like just kind of inflating your type scale, doing that in M's is pretty awesome, because it automatically sizes everything down the tree.
Well, you can do that with rems too. You just need to do it on the HTML element, because that's the root element.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote an article once that was theoretical, and I have tried this a little bit here and there, is to use, how did I even do this? Pixels at the root. So imagine your HTML element has font size 20 pixels. And then rem at the component level. So I have a sidebar, it has a little ad in it with some text, and I've said, make that a little smaller than usual, because it's in the sidebar. I'm going to say, set that font size 0.9 rem or whatever. But now that's just like setting the tone for that widget. Then inside that, use M's. So it's kind of like, well, I want to bump the H1 and the H2 inside this widget in the sidebar relatively or whatever. What's kind of cool about that is now I can do the Trent Walton thing or whatever, which is add a media query, kind of globally increase and decrease the size of the fonts across the entire website, because you're like, oh, whatever, their fonts, their screen is bigger than 1500 pixels, they probably need a little bump up in font size to make this thing feel a little better, and it's like super big close, you know, great. But then you're like, well, but you know, maybe this widget over here needs a little tweak, like that didn't work, like the global increase didn't perfectly do everything I wanted it to. Well, now you can make tweaks based on the component, not necessarily requiring you to go in with a microscope and start touching little tiny things. So it gives you like this slightly smaller scoped thing. Be like, okay, I think I'm gonna leave these sidebar widgets alone. So I have REM at the component level to use. And then if you need the microscope, you still have it with the M. So I kind of explain it in the article. In practice, I haven't actually like adhered to this perfectly. I actually find that like this conversation is like not boring, but just like, I don't know, just use whatever. It's not that difficult of a thing. Controlling font sizes, just do it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's even crazier things like VH and VW units that I've been getting into because I kind of like sizing based on a viewport. That sounds fun.
It is. And have you seen the one where you're like the root font size is like 20 pixels, but plus like two VWs or something, like
so really like min maxes or something.
Yeah, well, it doesn't min max, but what it does is it's not like really strongly tied to the viewport. It just gives it a little taste of the viewport. So as you resize it, it just comes up a little bit in size, which is kind of fun. It's not like whoa as soon as it gets big. It's not intended for the, you know, like me and you made you mostly and
like fit text and
yeah
fit like, or just the like. Like
that is like really, really tied to viewport. That's just saying I want you to be the exact same size. You know, it's really
well. Balloon-y. Actually, it's tied to the parent. It's parent element.
Yeah, in this
container query,
which is not possible. And maybe there should be you know, while they're talking about container queries, maybe they should have CVH and CV.
Oh, gosh, I would love. Oh, CSS. You don't know who your parents are. You never acknowledge your parents, CSS, and that's your problem.
I saw some new thing the other day called Max.
That you're violating a biblical commandment, CSS. Goodness.
It seems like they break that. Everybody's always like, well, we can't because, I don't know, performance or a fast track or, you know, there seems to be things. And then they break that rule all the time. It seems like I saw some new spec with max lines and like nth fragment or something. It looked like the first way ever that you could like say, oh, I want the first three lines of this article to be double the font size as the rest of it, which you can't really do right now. You have first line, but you don't really have nth line, you know? Mm-hmm. And now it looks like there's going to be a way to do that. But the usual argument against that is, well, when we bump up the font size, words fall off the end of it and aren't on the third line anymore. So it creates this like cyclical logic situation. But it works, so whatever.
It seems like browsers should be able to do it, but I don't doubt it's hard. All right. Well, good luck, Mark. I think just pick something and go with it is the best. I think that's what we're all doing.
Do a good
is that
job.
Right? Is that?
Yep.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Rollbar. That's rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. That's the URL you want to go to get 3 months of their bootstrap plan for free. Rollbar is all about error tracking. It does an amazing job of that. So you know, it's really easy to integrate too, and it integrates into any application, you know, JavaScript, which is Ember, Angular, Backbone, Node.js, or your Ruby stack with Rails, .NET, PHP, even Flash, iOS, anything. They've got it all covered. You put it in there and it starts capturing the errors that your app throws, which it's definitely throwing some, believe me, and lets you know about them. So not only so you need to know what these errors are in order to fix them, gives you the stack trace and all that, it groups them intelligently too. So if your app is like throwing like thousands of this one kind of error, but it's kind of minor, it's good to know. It's good to not get an email about every single time that error happens thousands of times. That's annoying. You know you need to fix it, but maybe it's lower priority than some other kind of bug and allows you to prioritize and that type of thing. It integrates with like Slack and Jira tickets and all that type of stuff too. So you kind of get to decide like, okay, put this type of error here or whatever. It allows you to, you know, gives you the information you need to fix the errors that are happening in your app and prioritize them and know about them, but not be too annoyed by them and stuff like that. Just a couple of lines of code to integrate into your app, whatever that app is. It's kind of amazing software. Thank you, Rollbar. Again, the URL is rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. $87 value to sign up for their Bootstrap plan for free.
All right, Carolyn Wood writes in, "Hi, thanks for your great podcast. I always enjoy catching up. Thanks. I've wondered if you consider doing a show about older people making the jump to tech. By older, I mean 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. I'm aware that in tech, 30 plus is often considered old, which I find hilarious. I'm 44 and started teaching myself front-end web dev at the end of 2014. Having gained a bit of experience around HTML in 99-2000, my current plan is to freelance building WordPress sites on Genesis, but I do sometimes think about getting a proper job. However, I have real concerns that my age, particularly because I'm a woman, would work against me, even though I love this work. I know I'm good at it, and I have lots of transferable skills from previous careers. I'd love to hear about people who made the jump at my age or later and managed to gain employment and set up a successful freelance career." That's a good topic. Also want to say thank you for discussing issues relating to discrimination in tech. It's important that people use the power to become aware that these issues are real. And I'm sure what you do helps with that. Well, thanks. We try. Chris, what do you think about a show for the olds? No, that's dismissive.
Sorry. No, I mean, I'm 35, right? Going on 36 later this month. How old are you? You're the same age as me.
36.
You? Yeah. Like, are we old in web dev? I guess I don't really feel it because I'm not like immersed in Silicon Valley or anything. You work in a shed out back. I work in my attic. You know, it's like there's not like 20 somethings running around everywhere.
Living the dream, man.
Yeah. Although I think I'm as smart as I've ever been about some tech stuff. But I do feel a little slower occasionally about, like, sometimes I see some kid just cruising around doing something that,
Jake Alba.
Jake is a great example of like a young, nimble mind. Jake needs to, you need to get older, Jake. Slow down.
Yeah. I'm going to give him a drinking habit or something.
He does that. But you know, I was working with like Gulp file. I'm on like hour three of like adjusting a Gulp file, and I've worked with Gulp a bunch of times. I've used production stuff or whatever, but still it's a very trial and error thing for me. I'm like, oop, I got the file path a little wrong. Oops, I piped it a little wrong. Oops, oops. And I'm like, is this me just being old? Anyway, that's not exactly what you're asking about, Carolyn, I understand. But I do, I wonder if that's going to get worse for me or whatever. But does that make me, like, not valuable and not possible to learn things? Absolutely not. I hope I'm in my 60s and finding a new career or still in tech or whatever, but doing something that, I don't know, nobody's laughing me off because I'm old.
Yeah, it's interesting. One thing I've been saying like lately is I feel like I have the skills to get me through my 30s, but I don't know if I have the skills to get me through my 40s. Does that make sense? Like, I'm sure I can keep making WordPress sites. I have to know what you
mean by that.
Or it's just kind of like the way they're being built, are they in 5 years, is it going to change so drastically that I will not know how to make a website essentially? Like
you're worried that you can't even hello world it. Like it'll be so foreign that your mind can't deal with it anymore.
I just wonder. I mean, the bar to React is a great example. The bar to enter React is so, whoa. Like you have to learn Webpack. You have to learn, which blows up in your face. You have to learn React, which blows up in your face. Redux, which blows up in your face. And you need kind of a lot of time and a lot of energy to get through it, right? It takes kind of,
but haven't we said in the past that like the education around it is so good? Like maybe it's because you're so busy with other things. Like you're busy building this product and you're busy being a dad and you're just at this stage in life, but that's just your stage in life. It's not your age. Like I would imagine, even if you're 60 right now, if you sat down and you had some basic computer skills and you took Wes Boss's course, you could get through that. You could be like, I have all the time in the world now. In fact, I hope that's the case because I'm hoping to retire and to like really digging into becoming a good banjo player. And like I'm not going to be as nimble and quick as the young kids, but I'm going to like dedicate big swaths of my day to it and go into it super open-minded. And I hope that I'm not too old to do it when I get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'd love to talk to people who are approaching this at a later age or got into it late, just like Carolyn's kind of saying. Because this does tend to be like a career that people chose when they're like 20 or something. And it just so happens that when you and I were 20, that was the year 2000. And that's when websites sort of took off or had a big jump just before the dot-com crash. And so... And then a lot of our peers are either kind of going into management or something, kind of getting out of the code. So it would kind of be interesting to see that as well. Like, are we all destined for the management path, or how does that work? Yeah. What is that?
Not to mention ageism kind of thing, you know, like you can't.
Oh, is that
a thing? Yes, of course it is. You know, if you were 55 and walked into some startup and handed your thing, you know, you'd probably get a bunch of BS about culture fit and stuff. So that's too bad, but you're going to face it. Yeah.
Well, and I'm trying to think, like, I think the people above 40 that I know from meetups and stuff, and that's very skewed because it's very, you know, you have time at night to go out. You're not, you know, busy with family or whatever. I think it's in the, like dozen to two dozen number of people, you know? So I would be, it is curious to me how,
haven't you been to a JavaScript meetup or whatever, where even if you're like, if you look around the room and you're like, wow, this is actually fairly gender diverse. So round of applause. Mm-hmm. This is fairly, racially diverse. Round of applause. Nice. And then stop there. But, you know, I've definitely been to ones that were both of those two things and then really should have been called 30-something JS because that's all that were there that way. You know, there's a lot of...
30-something JS. Sorry, registering a domain.
Yeah.
that's pretty fair. We're at Clarity Conference. Can we talk? I crashed Clarity. Mm-hmm. That's Gina Bolton's kind of... It was about style guides that year. And the closing speaker was... The man who made the NASA style guide, the style guide for NASA. And wasn't that just amazing? Like,
well, that was some age diversity for sure.
Well, he's 84 or something. That was like his birthday or something. And he's 80 and giving a talk. And it really struck me. It's like, how many conferences have I been to where an 80-year-old man with all their wisdom spoke? And it's great, zero.
He didn't just spoke. This is Richard Daney. Wasn't just spoken, but was practicing design with his wife. They have a
yeah. They like rebooted his consultancy, kind of. And so
I think that's fun to use examples like that. And I know there's probably not like tons of 80-year-old people still practicing design, but the fact that there's any is like is good and encouraging and awesome. I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to hear more. Hopefully we can.
I did a talk one time where I opened it up with that, like things are moving too fast kind of stuff. Like, how can I possibly keep up with this? And then I did like five or six people that did amazing things later in life. One of the classic examples is the Colonel, you know? He started
Colonel Sanders.
Yeah, he started that. Oh, God, what was he, 60 or something before he even started that thing? Something like that. There's this woman named Granny D who was really into campaign finance reform and decided to walk across the entire United States in support of it, which was awesome. How old was she when she did that? She was born in 1910. So there you go.
Wow.
Between the ages of 88 and 90. Anyway, that's not tech, but, you know, if she can do that, she could have learned React. I decided.
No, that's fair. I think there's a lot of people. I actually know quite a few people who have, like, left, like, teaching careers and after they went to grad school and did all this stuff, and then they did teaching, and then they're like, no, I don't like teaching, so I'm going to do tech stuff. And I know a lot of people getting into tech, like, in the last 2 or 3 years, friends of mine who... just learning it totally green, totally new. And it's impressive. I think it can be done. So I'm not discounting it, but I'm just curious what life after 40 is like.
Yeah. Well, we're going to find it.
All right.
I want to be a manager. So I'm a little different that way. I don't plan on changing careers. I hope to be leading a team. That's
Okay, well, let me go to Amazon and order you a rayon shirt, Chris. Okay, thanks, Carolyn. We'll try to do a better job at that, try to put together a show. Okay, next question is from Paul Stonier. Any tips on process for getting content from clients? Ooh, this is a tough one. We've tried stuff like Dropbox folders, master Word docs, etc. Getting it all wrangled into a clear deliverable feels harder.
It's fascinating too. I'm not often in this position, but I'm interested in it because that, you know, I like that you use the word process, Paul, because I think that is a big part of it, right? Like a lot of us tech people focus on the tech problems in front of us when building a website, even though we're aware that getting the content is so important and all that stuff. We might try to solve this problem by being like, well, I set up a shared Google document. Why didn't you use that? Or like,
you know. Why is nobody like going into the database?
Or whatever. And like giving them the perfect CMS is fine too, but like, do you want to go there? Is that what you're expecting them to use on day one? Or is it easy? You know, I feel like I've tried other, you know, in previous lives, tried other tricks, like just email it to me, write however you want, you know, send me a dot doc. I don't care. I'll find a way to deal with it or whatever, you know, like do you go loosey goosey and say, just whatever, just send it to me, however, or do you give them some structure, you know, like, please put it in this Dropbox folder, you know, please follow this template, please fill in this form.
I think a lot of people have success with kind of a interview sheet, you know, like a document that you just fill out. And we actually hit this problem on Day Trip. We're trying to get some content from some people. We were trying to figure out a process to do it. And we did the thing where it's like, hey, here's kind of what we're looking for. Can you fill out this Excel spreadsheet? And it just kind of didn't work. And no one like responded instantly. And so I just kind of like thought to myself, like, when have I like just volunteered, just giving content, given information, you know, and that's not to say like we're like weaseling people, but like for like a blog, like somebody, a blog will email me for information or to contribute to a thing. And I'm like, has that been successful? And when it's been successful, when it's like five questions that will take about 15 minutes to consider, that's sort of what I envisioned. And so we kind of re-architected how we would kind of get, you know, questions from people. We did like a Google form and sent that out, and we had responses instantly. Like so the conversion rate
form was, like, was good.
Yeah. The conversion rate, like having like five questions that in your brain will take like 15 minutes, that's way more successful than just dumping them into a fill out this document entirely thing. Cause it like shifts it from work to something. And once you know, like who's active and participating, like who's giving content, now you can kind of like shape that, and kind of dig in into each question. Like once you know kind of one thing about them, maybe follow up in email and say like, okay, for your about page, you just said we're a business analytics company. Can you tell me more? What makes you unique? And that's an easier question to answer than make about page text, you know? So that's what I would say is kind of, you need these kind of nudges again.
Right. Don't say, Taylor don't, like, just to put a point on what you just said, don't say, send me the content for the about page. You know, you got to give them more prompts than that, give them why it matters. Maybe without dwelling on it or being too metaphorical or whatever, you can be like, you know, part of our job as designers is to start with some content, or maybe don't even say the word content because it's so, you know, loaded or whatever, is to gather stuff from you, to listen to you about what you have to say, about what you're doing and stuff. And that informs what we're about to design. So it would be better if we got that, you know, before and during and as part of this process, rather than kind of making a design and waiting to fill in the blanks.
Yeah, no, I think that's like the best way to do it, is kind of sort of sort of draw a path that you want to take or the kind of information. And then if you need to follow up, you can always follow up. But the goal, if you're A-B testing or something, is trying to just get a response. What gets me a line of text, you know? And then you kind of have to brute force or machine learn your way to how do I get 10 lines of text.
Try multiple things too. So, because again, like I like your form idea. I like that we have a kind of a deliverable for Paul here to try. But it's not just the like what's the best way. I think the best way is to keep trying things and keep imparting its importance, and then like note what works and iterate on that, because it's a process problem. It's a people problem. It's a education problem. It's not just a tech problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that's the, my new A Book Apart book. Are you ready? Is happy to announce it is, the people problems of web design. Mm. So there you go. That's what I'm working on. I'm just very interested in these people problems. Like, how do you get content from people? What's a tried and true way, you know, or in the TLDR is that people are different. And so you just have to find out what works for this type of person that you're dealing with. Are they type A, type B? Are they audio, visual? You know, what's their like learning style? What do they respond to? You kind of need to know that or figure that out. There's a little bit of psychology, you know. So
love it. Hey. Dan Shields writes in, I thought a very cool thing, speaking of Wes Boss's course, which is the canonical React course, I guess. Was the first video on getting your dev environment set up, which is, I agree. It's a great way to start a thing. It's so important. You know, that's what Hello Worlding is about, really, is about getting to the point where you can write a line of code and execute it and then see what it does, right? And that feels very empowering, certainly. Dan continues, I thought it was beneficial to see another developer's workflow and project setup. The NPM approach is well documented these days. Using Browserify, BrowserSync, and Gulp are great tools when you're setting up a single project that you will work on all the time. I've had a harder time integrating those tools into my client work, where on any given day I'm working on several projects. The Gulp projects I've seen online for CMS sites like WordPress tend to be just the theme directory, so you can't utilize Gulp for other parts of the project, like, for example, running a web server. So I'm still using the MAMP Pro CodeKit approach for that type of project. I'd love to hear if you guys have locked into a workflow to solve this particular issue, or generally if there are parts of your workflow that you think are cool and worth sharing. So Dan's like, okay, well, I have my weird React setup, and I have my Gulp setup for some projects, and I have my CodeKit MAMP setup for other thing. I tell you, Dan, I live in that same world. I have many different development projects for many different projects, and I guess I don't dwell on it as a negative. I almost think of it as an interesting positive, almost, that there's some diversification in that world and don't struggle with it too much.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I have like tens of different environments that I kind of maintain based on the project. And, you know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe I'm truly doing a use the tool that suits the job thing, but I don't know. Isn't it sort of Darwinistic? You sort of pick up something in one project, you do a mutation, and that mutation kind of carries through to the other projects or not. Or it just was a single mutation that you'd never do ever again. Like I have a lot of Gulp projects, but I don't remember the last time I intentionally fired up Gulp. I think I have to use it to compile CSS on my blog. I have a pretty good Jekyll setup. I just love Jekyll. I'm using it right now on two or three little projects. And so I like Jekyll. So I use Jekyll, Jekyll archives, and then another one. I'll have to remember.
Which means that you need Ruby going on, which means that you have Ruby installed on your system, which isn't too big of a deal, right? Although I think you struggled with it a little more so on Windows land.
Yeah, but now I'm kind of full bash on Ubuntu on Windows.
Okay, which so cool, all good so. To go there. But has things like Docker compelled you to be, you know, because that's a part of this too, is that then that's like a step up almost in that, okay, so you have your, I don't know, your Browserify setup or whatever, and now you have, and then you have this different setup and this different setup. It's kind of appealing to chuck all those in little mini containers, isn't it? So that, I don't know, they don't affect other things. For example, you could run your Ruby in a Docker, I would think, and that way it's like totally isolated from anything else.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a virtual machine. So I have like a Ruby machine in my, like, wouldn't that would be kind of nice.
I suspect things will move more so that way. In fact, they already are, I think for most like development projects of scale and of consequence, that tends to be the setup is VMs.
Yeah, because there's a little bit of like they're called containers, but if you think of virus containment, you know, if your production environment and your local environment are out of sync, like 1%, it can run into problems. Like I have a problem where Windows compiles a gemlock, or Windows Ruby on Rails will take the gem file, create a gemfile.lock of all the gems I'm using with all the versions. And I push that to Heroku. And Heroku says, oh, Windows made this. I'm not going to use it. I'll just install gems on my own. Well, it installed newer versions of the gems than were on my machine. Breaking changes, things like stuff's filling, spilling all over the floor. People can't log in. And it's just like, oh, didn't expect that from like a one-liner fix. You know, that was totally unintended. So I think, you know, in the future, like this idea that you have a packaged shipped container that you just deploy that container and the server is like, great, I love containers, I eat containers, I'll just launch your container. I think that's probably the future. Just
right. So it's your dev environment of all the, and your production environment.
Yeah. I mean, your production and dev environment should be close to 1-to-1.
Right.
Like they shouldn't be like 10 or 2 separate instances. They should be kind of the same thing.
And then the beauty of it is if you have a different one for a different project, that's okay. It's just in another container. It might might use Gulp and one doesn't, but whatever. It's still isolated in this kind of container land. I would think knowing lots of different workflow kind of thing. Dan kind of asked us if we're locked into one particular workflow, and it sounds like, no, not really.
No, I mean, it's sort of like what you're using pushes you to a workflow. I mean, Jekyll pushes you to Ruby. I mean, if I'm doing something from total scratch, I like Gulp, but you know, maybe somebody was a fan of Grunt, and so they just said, oh, I'm going to build this in Grunt, and I kind of have to deal with that. And you know, if you're using React, it pushes you into Webpack, and not that you have to, but it just, these kind of conventions will push you into something. So you have to be kind of aware of what you're choosing and what it's pushing you into. You know, I think WordPress pushes you into the MAMP sort of code kit style thing. And,
it does.
And
that's it's okay, interesting because they don't have to. There's so many different ways. I mean, you certainly could use code kit in your Jekyll setup if you wanted to. You just tend not to because most of the, I don't know, the culture or something of the...
mm-hmm. Yeah, or even the design. It's designed to chew through SAS. So, like Ruby was or SAS is a Ruby library. It's now C binary, but you know, it like Ruby does that. That's native Ruby. That's a native Ruby technology, SAS. So, so Jekyll's like, oh, I can do the SAS because I know Ruby. So, oh. That's maybe simplifying everything.
Yeah. But. I like just to go back to the container thing for a minute, I really like it. And we've been, you know, Tim Sabat on our team has been doing a lot of work with that. And our thing is so great, you know, to onboard somebody's like, here's your Docker container. You know, what else? Nothing. You know, it runs everything. It's got it all.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. See, that's beautiful. I wish I had.
I mean, he's still working on it a little bit. So at the moment, there's only one thing I have to do, and is open a terminal and type this one command, which is basically like, it's like our fancy version of Rails server or whatever. It's just, okay. It's like bin spring, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, oh, I figured out a way that can run in there too. So done. So it's so you just nothing. It used Docker to be like, VM, oh, we have to.
And it's going.
Yeah, which like Redis is already going. And, you know, the right Ruby is in there and MySQL is in there. And the actual, you know, not just running MySQL, but the database as well. And everything. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of little containers that run.
Huh.
And it's cool. And now Docker for Mac apparently has made it a lot easier, but there's, you know, Docker for all the, it just gives you a nice little menu bar app or whatever. Apparently that made it easier. But I think Docker's for all platforms and not the only choice.
Huh. All right. All right. Well, hopefully we answer your question, Dan. Chris, I think it's time to
I think it is too.
Well, thanks everyone for listening and downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. We really appreciate it. Be sure to star, heart, favorite this up, and that's how people find out about the show. Tweet about it. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. Anything else, Chris? If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. People want to hire you. And Chris, you got anything else? I can't.
Speaking of jobs, there was one that was posted in the last 25 seconds or so. Let me just read it out loud just for fun.
Okay.
Lead front-end developer at Firefly Learning Limited in London. There you go. Okay, so Shop Talk.